I've heard. Haverford used the wrought-iron poker to rearrange the peat and coals. He put the poker back on the hearth-stand, though delivering a stout blow to Brantford's thick sense of his own consequence, appealed strongly. "I delight in Mrs. Sherborne's outspokenness," Haverford said. "She's a refreshing change from the toadies and flirts who have nothing better to do than gossip about the same people they attempt to flatter." Brantford saluted with a silver flask and tipped it to his lips. "Just so, just so. I've been asked why I invested in Sherborne's little project by those same people. Why entangle my affairs with such as him? He's part owner of a bank, you know. One of the other partners is the grandson of a Ludgate jeweller."
Which had exactly nothing to do with anything.
"I'll tell you why I'm investing with Sherborne," Brantford went on. "I'll never begrudge a man's efforts to better his situation if those same efforts also better my situation. Everything Sherborne touches turns to gold. He's shrewd, has a knack for knowing when to step in and when to step out. As distasteful as coin might be to those of us raised with refined sensibilities, the lack of coin is more distasteful still."
A lack of couth ranked even higher on Haverford's list of disagreeable qualities.
"And yet you clearly had sufficient means to invest. One hopes your own situation prospers adequately, irrespective of Sherborne's projects."
Brantford emptied his flask.
"Was that a warning, Haverford? Have I backed the wrong horse? That's why I'm wandering about the wilds of Wales, you see. Sherborne himself challenged me to inspect the colliery, more or less, likened solicitors and men of business to meddlers. He doubtless never expected to see me here in person. I have better things to do than ruin my boots and court a case of lung fever."
Haverford had better things to do than listen to this braying ass.
"Though here you are, in the wilds of Wales after all."
Brantford rose, a bit unsteadily.
"So I am. I need for Sherborne's little project to show a handsome profit. He has odd notions about providing housing for the miners. No children employed below the surface, no women either. And that's just the start of his daft fancies. I'll set him straight. And a word from you would be helpful, too. One cannot coddle the brutes who labour for their bread, or they simply take advantage."
His lordship wandered over to the sideboard and lifted a glass stopper from a crystal decanter.
"Mind if I refill my flask?"
"Help yourself, of course. We keep country hours, and if you'd like to rest before changing for dinner, I can send a footman to waken you."
Brantford made a mess and wasted good brandy refilling his flask.
"Don't send me a footman, for heaven's sake. Send me a hot bath and a comely little chambermaid to assist me. I like blondes and prefer a woman with good hips. A tray of viands wouldn't go amiss. And none of this peat, please. Coal will do for me, and I'll need some clothing pressed if I'm to be properly attired for dinner."
"I'm sure the staff will be happy to meet your every need,"
though Her Grace had already warned the butler and housekeeper that only men were to wait on his lordship.
"If Sherborne is not amenable to your ideas regarding management of the colliery, will you withdraw your support for the project?" "I ought to," Brantford said, snatching the last biscuit from the tea-tray. "That would serve him right. He got quite above himself with me. I admire ambition, but will not tolerate disrespect."
Brantford ate his biscuit as the fresh peat caught, and the lovely, tangy scent of a blazing fire filled the parlour.
"Here's the thing, Haverford. I have been beset lately by something of a premonition."
He ran a hand through thinning hair, and for a moment Brantford was not the arrogant, confident aristocrat, but rather a man who could see middle age bearing down upon him much sooner than expected. He was weary and worried, though he probably didn't admit that even to himself.
"My in-laws are in Dun territory," Brantford said. "Their situation is not common knowledge yet. They put every spare farthing into the marriage settlements,
and I've done what I could with those funds. My countess has yet to oblige me with an heir, though not for lack of trying on my part. I have it in my mind, you will think me addled, that if I can replenish her family coffers, then she might conceive.
To make that admission, Brantford had to be nearly drunk, or very preoccupied with his lack of children.
"A titular succession can be a terrible weight,"
Haverford said.
"Have you no indirect heirs? Some bantling second cousin in Scotland. I'd rather see the estate revert to the crown than fall into the hands of a barbarian."
Two of Elizabeth's sisters had married Scotsmen.
"I can't promise that Sherborne will be amenable to your suggestions. He's developing this colliery, in part, to provide employment beyond what's available on the valley's small holdings and tenant farms. Excessive profit isn't his aim."
Which had surprised Haverford, and it apparently surprised Brantford.
"Excessive profit is a contradiction in terms. I'll sort him out easily enough, Your Grace. If he ever wants to attract another titled investor, he'll see reason. About that bath."
"Right," Haverford said. "Your bath, a tray of viands, somebody to see to your wardrobe and lay out your evening clothes. Anything else?"
"Coal on the bedroom hearth. Peat has its charm, but not while a man is trying to sleep."
Brantford started for the door.
"I'm partial to French wines, if you were wondering what to send along with the tray. I prefer the reds, as long as they aren't too dry."
"Our staff will be happy to oblige." Brantford took himself off, while Haverford recited the Earl's list of required amenities to the first footman.
"Mind you don't let the maids near him," Haverford said. "He's our guest, but Her Grace will skewer him with a rusty sword if he disrespects any member of her household.
Not, of course, that food and wine in abundance, a hot bath on demand, footmen stepping and fetching in all directions, and a hearth kept blazing was coddling his lordship. Haverford used the footman's staircase to join the Duchess in the ducal apartment, and found his wife awake, though beneath the covers with a book.
"I'd hate him," Haverford said, "except I'd pity the man."
"Brantford?"
"Of course, Brantford. You thought I meant Sherborne?"
"Come to bed," Elizabeth said. "Our guest has put you out of sorts."
"He's put me in a quandary."
Haverford did not need to be invited to bed twice. He peeled out of his clothes, all of them, and climbed in beside his wife.
"Brantford is greedy, which is probably to be expected, but he's also in want of an heir. He refers to Sherborne as having a Midas touch, and yet the legend of Midas seems to apply to the Earl."
"Midas turned his daughter to gold, didn't he?"
"And realized too late that all the coin and consequence in the world mean nothing without somebody to love. I could have been Brantford."
He'd made the last admission quickly, before self-consciousness could snatch the words back. Elizabeth wrapped herself along his side.
"You could never be Brantford, else you would have sunk a mine 10 years ago and ignored all the agricultural interests in the valley. You would never have married me either. You would have married some giggling heiress who left you to moulder away with your books. Sherborne will deal easily with Brantford."
"If Sherborne fails to impress Brantford, the Earl will try to withdraw his money."
Why did the scent of Elizabeth, the simple feel of her body, soothe Haverford when nothing else could?
"Can Brantford renege like that? Lucas Sherborne strikes me as a man who'd tidy up all the legalities before coin changed hands."
Haverford pulled the covers over his wife's shoulders.
"Doubtless Sherborne has dotted I's and crossed T's in triplicate. But Brantford will slander Sherborne in the clubs if Sherborne doesn't give the money back, or manage the project according to Brantford's rules. That will be the end of Sherborne's ventures with titled investors."
Sherborne, for reasons Haverford only dimly grasped, wanted to move among titles as an equal.
"Then you and Radnor and various Wyndhams will simply unslander him," Elizabeth said. "Brantford is a minor northern earl, with heirs above his station. Sherborne is ours now, and we protect our own. spoken like a duchess.
Also like a Wyndham and a St. David.
Is it very rude for a host and hostess to be late for dinner?
I haven't yet told the kitchen when dinner is to be served.
Nor will you be telling them for at least another hour.
Spoken like a duke,
Elizabeth said, drawing her leg over his thighs.
Like a very wise duke.
He's here.
Sherborne might have been speaking of Old Scratch, so grim was his tone.
Lord Brantford has arrived?
Charlotte asked. They were in the library after a quiet supper. Rain pelted the windows in icy torrents, and darkness had fallen hours ago. While her husband had clicked away at an abacus and penciled figures on sheets of foolscap, Charlotte had read Mr. William Sharp's treatise on coal mining, which was more interesting than any edition of La Belle Assemblée. Mining was an endeavour made possible by tons of mathematics, as well as tons of ore. Without a quantity of careful calculations, the whole business was little more than digging in the dirt, while relentlessly praying to remain alive. To construct a tunnel that would not collapse, flood, subside, or lack for ventilation was a puzzle of numbers, and until those numbers came right, lives were in peril. Sherborne pitched a crumpled-up note into the fireplace behind his desk. A second fireplace before Charlotte's perch on the sofa burned just as brightly.
"Haverford welcomed Brantford shortly before sunset," he said. "The weather will prevent us from touring the site tomorrow."
"If his lordship is so keen to inspect his investment, then he ought to brave the elements," Charlotte said. "You certainly haven't let rain, cold, wind, hail, or dark of night stop you from being there."
Sherborne rose, braced his hands on the mantel, and arched his back.
"Have you missed me, Mrs. Sherborne?"
The question was more weary than flirtatious, perhaps even a trifle annoyed.
"Ever since last week's dinner party, you have been preoccupied."
Charlotte patted the cushion next to her.
"Come sit with me."
Sherborne cast a longing glance at his calculations, though Charlotte knew they did not call to him the way they did to her. Sherborne was worried, and his fretting required him to do something, not simply sit and read a week-old London newspaper to keep up with the gossip. He took the place beside her.
"You have made a nest on my sofa. If you've bided here to keep me company, you needn't."
Charlotte pushed her quilts aside, rose, and stood before her husband.
"Boots off, Mr. Sherborne."
He extended his left foot, expression wary. His boots were worn, though this pair lacked any evidence of mud. Charlotte took off first one, then the other, and set them in the corridor. She pulled up a hassock and put her husband's feet in her lap.
"Has it occurred to you, sir, that you might have been keeping me company?"
She wrapped her arms around his feet.
"My aunt likes to have her feet rubbed. This is a family secret. Are your feet cold?"
Sherborne's manner had been colder lately. Preoccupied, quiet, reserved, worried, very likely.
"My feet are tired," Sherborne said,
leaning his head back against the cushions.
"Shall we to bed?"
"Soon. Have you had a look at Debrett's?"
Charlotte had suggested that exercise over breakfast yesterday.
"I have, and can tell you that Brantford is the 8th Earl of that title, the Viscountcy having been raised to an earldom by Charles II. The present Earl is married to the former Miss Veronica Carruthers, of the Carruthers family of East Anglia, and her father is a baron. No children have yet graced Brantford's nursery, which means I had less to memorize."
"No children will be gracing our nursery yet either."
Heat flooded Charlotte's cheeks as soon as she'd made that announcement. Sherborne regarded her for a stern moment, then his brows rose.
"The inevitable inconvenience troubles you?"
She peeled off his stockings.
"These things happen in the ordinary course."
Though how did couples discuss them?
"Shall I sleep elsewhere?"
"You needn't."
Sherborne often began the night stretched out on his side of the bed, staring at the canopy, arms crossed behind his head. When Charlotte woke in the middle of the night, she was invariably wrapped in his embrace, and he in hers.
"You're sure?" he asked. "It wouldn't be any bother."
Charlotte had a nagging suspicion her husband would rather sleep elsewhere, but that for him to establish his own quarters on some higher floor of the house was the wrong direction to go at this point in their marriage.
"I'd miss you, Mr. Sherborne. You are a lovely bedfellow."
A week ago he might have returned that compliment. Now the fire hissed and popped at Charlotte's back, and the silence grew. She rubbed his feet, taking time to learn more of him, and casting around for a topic that did not involve the mine, the Earl of Brentford, or immediate family.
"Does your ankle ever pain you?"
"The memory of sprawling on my face before the entire dining hall of boys pains me."
"Was that mishap courtesy of the same helpful soul who broke your nose?"
His nose had been broken at public school, though it had healed almost undetectably.
"One of his loyal henchmen, and a different one, broke my arm. They ran around in a pack, laughed at one another's jokes, got drunk together. Typical younger sons and lordlings. That feels good."
She adventured to the thick muscles of his calf.
"With whom did you run around and get drunk?"
"Nobody. And I learned not to excel at my studies either."
"But you're quite right."
A smile quirked and was gone.
"Coming from you, that's high praise. At school, if I did poorly, I was an ignorant mushroom, trying to get above my station. If I did well, I was a presuming upstart who needed to be put in his place. I was beaten for mumbling, for a disrespectful tone of voice, for not reciting quickly enough, for rushing through my recitations, for failing to respect my betters when the other boys made up all manner of lies about me. My father laughed and told me I was getting exactly the education I needed."
Charlotte hugged his feet.
"Is that the education you envision for our sons?
An education in prejudice, isolation, brutality, and snobbery?"
"We haven't any sons yet, and apparently none on the way."
Charlotte was tempted to shove his feet off her lap, storm out, and lock the bedroom door. She didn't, because in casual admissions and pensive silences, she was coming to understand how much courage Sherborne had displayed when he'd married her. Those young fools, breaking his bones for sport, had been from the best families. The instructors and headmasters, seizing on any pretext to beat him, had been beholden to those same families. Brentford, who expected a handsome return on his investment, acted as if he were doing Sherborne a favour by adding to Sherborne's burdens. The very neighbours who'd boxed Sherborne into turning a profit from an exorbitantly expensive new venture were titled aristocrats, held in high regard throughout the realm. And thanks to Charlotte, they were also Sherborne's family. She was his wife. He'd have her loyal support, and others could learn from her example.
"Tomorrow morning," Charlotte said, "you send a cheerful note over to Haverford Castle, welcoming Brentford to the neighbourhood. You inform him that your lady wife is eager to entertain him as the first official guest following our nuptials, and that all at the colliery is in readiness for a tour on the first available fine day."
The past few days had seen a flurry of busyness at the works, with string pegged out to mark the houses atop the hill, the first of the tram tracks laid, and labourers from both the Haverford and Radnor holdings swelling the ranks of the masons.
"I'm to be cheerful?"
Sherborne lifted his feet from Charlotte's lap and pulled on a stocking.
"Perhaps you ought to send this note. Cheerfulness eludes me lately."
She picked up the other stocking.
"I can draft the note, but it must be written in your hand. Where is Debrett's?"
"You don't have it memorized?"
Charlotte balled up the stocking and pitched it at Sherborne's head.
"Written correspondence requires different forms of address than greetings offered in person. What is Brentford's Christian name?"
Sherborne donned the second stocking and rose.
"Quinton. The family name is Bramley, if I recall his signature. Charlotte, may I ask you something?"
"Of course."
"How do you know a Harold Porter
from rural Brecknockshire.
Sherborne stood above her, looking tall, tired, and unreadable by the firelight. Charlotte rose and kissed him, while her mind whirled.
"An old, old friend. I went to school with his sister."
"Young ladies do not correspond with single gentlemen," Sherborne said. "I may not have taken any firsts at university or spent much time with my nose in Debrett's, but I know that much."
"Mr. Porter is married, as am I."
And Helwyn was in for a severe talking to, for Charlotte had asked that the letter to Mr. Porter be taken directly to the posting inn.
"Are you reading my correspondence now, Mr. Sherborne?"
He looped his arms around Charlotte's shoulders.
"I need for this mine to succeed, Charlotte."
What did that have to do with letters to old friends and Mrs. Wesley's?
"Then I need for it to succeed as well."
They would have remained thus, touching but not exactly embracing before the fire, except Charlotte took the initiative and stepped closer, resting her cheek against Sherborne's chest. They had not had a pleasant evening together, though neither had it been unpleasant. Charlotte mentally began composing a note to his lordship, Quinton, Earl of Brantford, a cheerful note, though it puzzled her that an eighth earl would be named Quinton. A fifth earl might have such a name, while an eighth would more likely be Octavius. She fell asleep beside Sherborne an hour later, and dreamed of calligraphy written in twine, his lordship's initials all tangled up with the colliery, the tram tracks, and Sherborne's stockings. When she woke in the middle of the night, she was not entwined with her husband. He was not, in fact, even in the bed. Chapter 16
"I'm reduced to delivering notes," Radnor said, passing along Haverford's epistle to Sherborne. "If you ever sought revenge on Haverford for past slights, he's suffering mightily now."
Sherborne broke the seal and read what Radnor probably already knew. "Sherborne, Brantford will join you for a tour of the works tomorrow at 3 o'clock, rain or shine. If you were to invite him to dinner thereafter, my Duchess would be ever in your debt, as would I. Haverford. P.S. Her Grace expects to be struck down, even bedridden, by a terrible megrim, no later than sundown tomorrow. She will, alas, decline any invitation to join your household for supper. I will remain loyally by my Duchess's side, offering what comfort I can." Brantford had spent 3 days underfoot at Haverford Castle, 3 days during which Sherborne had rehearsed optimistic speeches, refined detailed estimates, and watched the rain dribble down the library window panes.
"His lordship is not good company?" Sherborne asked. "Unlike you, Haverford has probably been troubling himself to be a decent host."
Radnor lifted a glass from the tray on the sideboard.
"May I?"
"Of course, but the noon hour has passed. I was about to ask if you'd prefer tea or a tray before the fire." Sherborne hadn't been about to ask any such thing. Failing to offer a guest libation was a gross oversight, and he could not afford to be making gross oversights, making more gross oversights.
"I am a bit peckish," Radnor said. "You aren't joining your lady wife for a midday meal?"
"Mrs. Sherborne is off to the vicarage, or avoiding her husband.
She and Miss Macpherson are hatching up some plot or other, involving the widows of the parish."
Radnor tossed back a nip of excellent French brandy.
"Will you order us lunch, or will it appear with a lift of your eyebrow?"
Sherborne went to the door and gave the footman instructions.
"If you'd also like to dictate the specific menu, Radnor, I'll send for the housekeeper, who will relay your wishes to cook. Did Haverford have anything else to say regarding Brantford?
And would it have been too much to ask that the ducal fundament grace a saddle to pay a call on nearby family to convey that information in person?"
"His Grace had much to say."
Radnor poured another glass of spirits and brought it to Sherborne.
"None of it fit for polite ears. He's a newly wed, and yet he takes his duties as a host seriously.
I expect the Duchess has had to ambush him in the conservatory a time or two.
Sherborne accepted the drink and set it aside.
His Grace is not newly wed, Radnor. He's recently married, relatively. The only gentleman in this valley who is yet enjoying his honey month is myself.
Radnor took a sip of his brandy, smallest finger extended.
You have a point, as usual. How is married life? Married life is lovely.
The problem was, married life with Charlotte truly could be lovely. She was both a well-bred lady and a restless mind that enjoyed challenges unbefitting of her station, such as being married to Sherborne, for example.
Your tone leaves me to question your veracity, Sherborne. Early days can be trying.
Though Sherborne rarely partook of strong spirits during daylight hours, he allowed himself to sample the brandy.
You are such a lord, Radnor. You've been married only a handful of weeks yourself, and you're already an expert on the institution. You must point out to me that Haverford, too, is newly married, when I attended the ceremony myself. You come bearing a note that tells me little except that I've incurred a debt to Haverford, and I'm supposed to thank you for the courtesy. Why are you really here?
Radnor set his glass on the mantel.
If you exhibit such faultless hospitality to Brantford, he'll withdraw his funds from the mine before Monday next. Is that what you want?
Maybe.
If he withdraws, I'll be hard-pressed to move forward at all. Is that what you want? You'll abandon the project you fought for years to bring into this valley?
Sherborne could not abandon the mine, not if he expected to support his wife and eventual children in the style they deserved.
I'm part owner of a bank, Sherborne said. The bank has recently come into some difficulties. A bank in difficulties is not good. Your lordly acumen is raining down like manna from heaven today,
while outside the sun was attempting to pierce the clouds. For Charlotte's sake, Sherborne was happy to see some decent weather. For his own sake, the longer he could put Brantford off, the better. Radnor stalked away from the mantel to stick his nose in Sherborne's face.
Permit me to visit upon you a short history lesson. I am a marquis.
My condolences on your misfortune.
The Marquisate of Radnor, like most marquisates, was established to honour the contribution of a lord of the marches, one granted many privileges beyond those given to mere earls and barons.
Long-windedness among those privileges, obviously.
The marquises of Radnor keep the peace,
Radnor said, jabbing a finger at Sherborne's chest.
I want your damned mine to succeed, you idiot, just as I want Haverford's flocks and farms to flourish. Why is your bank failing?
The bank is not failing, Sherborne said. It's in difficulties.
5 years ago, the other directors insisted on lending money to a canal scheme. I was against it. Why? Canals can be quite profitable. We have enough canals, and steam power will soon connect what few canals need connecting. The mines have already started using steam to haul ore from the collieries to the ironworks, and that trend will only continue.
Radnor smoothed his fingers over Sherborne's cravat and stepped away.
Is that why you're so hell-bent on this damned mine? You want to see our horses put to pasture by steam locomotives? Nasty, odoriferous things, if you ask me.
Sherborne hadn't, asked Radnor.
Your horse's fragrance is unfailingly delightful. Perhaps he's an equine, Marquis.
Radnor fetched his glass.
I sold up my last canal shares when Wellington got bony and buttoned up. Steam interests me, can't deny that. I gather it doesn't interest your bank.
If I can make good use at the colliery of current science where steam is concerned, the other directors will get their minds out of the past. A great deal of money is to be made by facing forward, but my directors are almost as bad as Haverford, clinging to— A tap on the door heralded lunch. Three footmen brought in a procession of trays, setting them down on the low table before the sofa. They bowed quite properly and withdrew.
The bowing is new, Sherborne said.
My wife has taken the staff in hand. The staff was thriving under the direction of a lady of the house who knew all the rules and when to bend them.
"Is Mrs. Sherborne taking you in hand?"
Radnor asked, seating himself before a tray.
"This is quite a feast. Do sit down. Running the world is hungry work. What will it take to bring your bank right?"
"Time," Sherborne said. "I'm a conservative investor. I choose projects that will yield a sure, steady return. Better than the cent per cent, and unlikely to fail. The mine was supposed to be such a project."
"This soup is delicious. Has your mine fallen into difficulties already?"
"You know about the mudslide. The beef and vegetable soup was comforting, and so, in an odd way, was this discussion with Radnor. He was no fool, despite having Haverford for a best friend."
"I know of no mudslide,"
Radnor said around a mouthful of buttered bread.
"Haverford has heard nothing about a mudslide, and I have it on good authority none of our labourers or masons will mention a mudslide in Lord Brantford's hearing."
Hannibal Jones had been instructed at length on the same topic.
"My thanks."
"You haven't told me why you've graced me with your presence, Radnor." His lordship rose and brought Sherborne his drink.
"My marchioness thought I needed to get out and socialize."
"You were driving the poor woman addle-pated." Sherborne had likely driven Charlotte addle-pated.
"Does your wife correspond with any old friends of the male gender?"
Radnor dipped his bread in his soup, the same as any yeoman might have.
"I should say not. She might tuck a note in with my own correspondence, add a few lines to a letter of mine, that sort of thing. Why?"
"No reason." "What can you tell me about the Cadenwall woman's situation?"
"The who? Oh, her. Poor creature went into service in Cardiff or Swansea, I forget which. She got with child, and that was that. As Griffin so baldly put it, she has a baby but no husband. Is that burgundy in this soup? I do fancy it."
How had Charlotte become aware of a fallen woman among Griffin's tenants? And why would she make a neighbourly gesture in that direction before she'd even called on the vicar?
"The recipe is French," Sherborne said. "Mrs. Sherborne brought many recipes with her, and the kitchen has been in constant readiness for a visit from Lord Brantford."
"Does he know about your situation at the bank?"
"I only found out the day following our little dinner party. The post brought all manner of disappointing news."
Would Mr. Porter write back to Charlotte? And would Sherborne intercept that letter if he did? When had Charlotte crossed the path of Mrs. Wesley Smythe of East Anglia, or Mrs. Wesley Scott in Liverpool?
"Brantford won't hear about your bank from me," Radnor said. "Nobody will."
"My thanks."
"I doubt you'll thank me for what I'm about to tell you now."
"Another mudslide?"
Whatever it was, Radnor had done a good job of keeping his own counsel, while Sherborne had prattled on about soup recipes and steam.
"Haverford and I are agreed that Hannibal Jones was negligent in his design of your retaining wall."
Charlotte felt the same.
"And?" "And I did a bit of corresponding with friends, and I think you have a problem in your hands."
The soup was no longer hot enough. Sherborne set his bowl aside and tore a slice of bread in half.
"Truly, your insightfulness astounds me, Radnor. I do indeed have problems on my hands."
Problems he'd like to discuss with Charlotte, if she ever came home.
"Hannibal Jones is a very competent engineer. Considering what I'm paying him, he should be a damned genius. But he apparently forgot that water weighs 62 pounds per cubic foot."
An inch of rain falling on a square foot of land weighed slightly more than 5 pounds, another fact Charlotte had passed along.
"He drinks,"
Radnor said gently,
"possibly to excess. The last mine he worked for suffered a tunnel collapse due to flooding. If the collapse had happened any day but the Sabbath, dozens of men, women, and children would have been trapped below the surface. The mine owners kept it quiet,
because they didn't want their misfortunes to become public.
Tunnels collapse, Sherborne said, though the very words left him queasy.
Mining is a hazardous undertaking. The miners warned him that water was leaching into the tunnel, warned him that his trusses were too far apart. He ignored them, and after the accident his drinking grew appreciably worse. If his drinking is still a problem, you will have to replace him as soon as Branford is done strutting about. I say that not only as a member of your board of directors, but as one who wants your venture to succeed.
The queasiness in Sherborne's belly became a burning that pushed up into his chest. Charlotte had offered to check Jones's calculations, and Sherborne had smiled and done nothing to provide her the figures.
"Have you any more cheering news to report?" Sherborne asked. "Glenys assures me we're to have rain tomorrow. Her left knee aches, and she claims that's a reliable predictor of bad weather."
"Then Branford will see the colliery in all its rainy splendour, and once I've subjected my household to his dubious company at dinner, we'll hope the grouse moors lure him away."
Radnor was soon back in the saddle, leaving his best wishes for Mrs. Sherborne, and a promise that he'd join the inspection tomorrow afternoon. Sherborne watched him ride off, not sure if the call had been friendly for all it was appreciated. Charlotte's dog-cart came up the drive, even as Radnor turned his horse onto the lane, and Sherborne waited in the chilly wind until he could assist his wife to alight from her vehicle. Morgan appeared from the stables to lead the horse away, and Sherborne abandoned all decorum to kiss his wife's rosy cheek.
"Mr. Sherborne, good day. The vicarage sends greetings. I hope you and Lord Radnor had a pleasant chat."
His lordship spread a pall of gloom, thicker than the foul miasmas wafting off the Thames in July.
Charlotte took Sherborne by the arm.
"This sounds serious, even for you. You must tell me all about it, and I shall explain how thrilled Vicar was that you have agreed to repair the church steeple."
Sherborne stopped halfway up the front steps.
"Charlotte, I cannot spare a single mason to repair a steeple that hasn't gone anywhere for nearly 300 years.
She peered up at him, nothing but concern in her eyes, despite how sharply he'd spoken.
"I was standing in the churchyard, visiting with Miss Macpherson, and a stone fell and nearly struck me on the head. I thought it was a sign from on high that I'd found the most public, charitable project for you to undertake. I'm sorry."
Many more such signs from on high, and Sherborne would be the one drinking to excess. He made it as far as the foyer, and even got the door closed before drawing Charlotte into his arms.
"I'll see to the steeple repairs, I promise, just as soon as Lord Brentford has pranced off on his merry way. He's coming to dinner tomorrow night, and will tour the works in the afternoon."
Charlotte stepped back to untie her bonnet ribbons.
"Shall I join this tour of the works? He will behave himself if I am on hand."
Sherborne undid the frogs of her cloak.
"You mean I'll behave myself. I'd rather let him do his worst than get rid of him once for all."
"What is the worst he could do?"
"Ruin me.
Withdraw his funds because I've misrepresented the state of the project, in which case I'll find another investor."
A near impossibility if Branford spoke ill of what he'd seen. Charlotte kissed Sherborne's cheek, treating him to a soothing hint of gardenia.
"As long as his lordship can do nothing serious, we shall contrive."
The same phrase she'd used when nearly in a swoon from her fear of heights.
"Shall we contrive with a shared midday nap, Mrs. Sherborne?"
The suggestion arrived to Sherborne's mouth without having given any notice to his brain. He had much to do, not enough time to do it, and canoodling with his wife wouldn't help one bit. Though it wouldn't hurt, either.
"Tomorrow,"
Charlotte said, going up on her toes to whisper in his ear,
"I am yet plagued by my inconvenience, but tomorrow I will be better able to share naps with you."
"Share a nap with me anyway."
Sherborne kept that sentiment to himself, for he didn't know what he'd be asking of her. Simple affection? A quiet respite from his worries? Rest?
"Another time, then. I'm sure you'll want to confer with Cook regarding tomorrow night's menu."
Charlotte slipped her arms around his waist. The butler had found someplace else to be, and thus Sherborne had a private moment with his wife. She simply hugged him, and before he could reciprocate the embrace, she was bustling off in the direction of her personal parlour.
"I am growing to dislike Quinton, Earl of Brantford," Charlotte said. "How does a man develop a head cold when he has not stirred from Haverford Castle for 3 days?"
His lordship had waited until early afternoon to send along a note postponing the tour of the works, and Charlotte had dispatched Morgan straight away to inform Sherborne at the colliery. The weather was beautiful, of course, mild, sunny, not much of a breeze. Gulls strutted around on the terrace, while Sherborne's expression across the small table beneath the maples put Charlotte in mind of sea cliffs, stoic and endlessly beset by the tides.
"You received this an hour past?" Sherborne asked,
studying the note she'd had taken to the colliery.
"Not even that. Will you eat something if I order you luncheon?"
Sherborne had been gone since dawn, and had come stalking across the garden's carpet of fallen leaves only 5 minutes ago. His hair was wind-blown, but he'd taken care with his wardrobe, even to wearing a gold cravat pin tipped with a small emerald. One didn't wear jewels during the day, but on Sherborne the effect was a dash of daring amid casual elegance.
"Brantford is toying with me," Sherborne said, gazing off toward the colliery. "He's rapping me on the nose with his newspaper, as if I'm a naughty puppy who piddled on the carpet."
Like the younger sons and lordlings who'd broken a young boy's nose, ankle, and arm for sport.
"I suspect he is simply enjoying ducal hospitality for as long as he can. Haverford was notably reclusive until this summer's house party. Brantford wants bragging rights, wants to be able to say he was the first guest their graces of Haverford welcomed after the nuptials. He doubtless hopes that Haverford will take him shooting, and if he attends services, he will delight in sitting in the ducal pew."
Sherborne set the note aside.
"They're like that, the titled snobs. They play those inane games. Haverford will kill me."
This last was said with a slight smile.
"Haverford is the one who accepted the Earl's request for hospitality," Charlotte replied. "He doubtless did so with the Duchess's blessing."
Also without consulting Sherborne, upon whom the Earl had come to spy. Sherborne's smile was gone, and he was again studying the lane that wound across the fields to the works.
"I should get back to the colliery. I thought I'd bring you some calculations to review, but I left them amid Mr. Jones's mess when I got your note."
Charlotte hadn't wanted to pester him for those figures.
"As it happens, I am not interested in calculations at present."
That got his attention.
"Are you well, Charlotte?"
"I am well. A midday respite with my husband would put me in the very pink."
Her ears had doubtless turned pink at that wifely boldness. Some kerfuffle among the seagulls sent them all winging upward, leaving Charlotte and her husband the only living creatures in the garden.
"As it happens, Mrs. Sherborne, I've been short of sleep myself lately."
Sherborne came to bed with Charlotte most evenings, but then he disappeared until all hours before snatching some rest before dawn. Truly, the Earl of Brantford had much to answer for.
"Give me a minute to have a word with the housekeeper," Charlotte said, "and I'll join you in the bedroom shortly."
The staff graciously accepted the news that the company dinner was postponed, despite preparations having been underway for hours. Charlotte let none of her own frustration show, though she didn't much care whether she made a good impression on his lordship or not. Sherborne cared, and thus Charlotte would do her utmost to be a charming hostess. She let herself into the bedroom, expecting to find her husband at the table, poring over one of his endless reports or estimates. Sherborne was face down on the mattress, naked and snoring gently, one foot hanging over the edge of the bed. He looked at once utterly immovable and vulnerable, a solid, sizable male, and a fallen warrior.
"I love you," Charlotte said softly. "I know not how or when this sentiment arose, but I love you,
and the Earl of Brantford will have to deal with that if he thinks to strut about your colliery and treat you with anything less than respect."
She sat on the bed to remove her boots, while Sherborne slept on undisturbed. Conflicting impressions, too hazy to qualify as thoughts, woke Sherborne. The first had become as familiar as his own heartbeat. He must away to the colliery. Jones might have a drinking problem. Something bedeviled the old man. The masons were squabbling with the yeomanry provided by Radnor and Haverford, and for reasons that Sherborne's tired brain refused to enumerate, a sense of dread made these problems pressing. Something else was pressing. Charlotte was tucked against Sherborne's side, her hand drifting along his chest and belly. Her touch was slow and sweet, and she tempted his attention away from anything having to do with the dratted mine. She was exploring him, even while she might have been trying to let him rest. Sherborne kept his eyes closed until Charlotte's expedition ventured south of his waist. He was more than half aroused, which state of affairs provoked her to cupping his stones and running a single finger around the tip of his cock.
"My wife has grown bold."
She sleeved him with her grip.
"I have always been bold, in some regards. The wife part is new. I was nobody's wife before."
Sherborne had been nobody's husband, nobody's family even. He'd been a disliked neighbour, a resented creditor, a ridiculed classmate. Long ago he'd been a disappointing son. What did Charlotte see in him, besides wealth, that was growing more imperilled by the day?
"I am your husband, and you are my wife until death do us part."
Charlotte was stuck with him, regardless of the fate of the mine, the bank, the infernal lending library scheme, regardless of anything.
"I like being your wife," Charlotte said, giving him a gentle squeeze. "You don't bore me. I hope you like being my husband."
She'd carefully not asked him a question. Sherborne turned on his side, the better to answer her without words. He kissed her on the mouth, then wrapped his hand around hers and showed her how to tease him. Charlotte delighted in knowledge. She would have puzzled this out on her own eventually, but Sherborne wanted to give her something, a gesture of trust, perhaps.
"You respond to this," she said, taking another slow, thorough tour of his stones.
"I enjoy it."
A vast understatement. Sherborne's worries and woes were falling away, his plans and estimates drifting into oblivion as his mind focused on one plea. "Don't stop." Charlotte took his hand and placed it over her breast, her bare breast. Sherborne matched her tempo, which had accelerated from a dreamy largo to a maddeningly placid andante. Surely he was losing his reason if the long-ago maunderings of his piano teacher were surfacing.
"I want you inside me," Charlotte said, arching into his hand. "Does that make me wanton?"
He slid his hand up to cup her cheek, and, of course, her cheek was hot against his palm. She'd closed the bed curtains, but there was light enough to see that she, too, had offered him a gesture of trust.
"Desiring your husband does not and never will make you wanton. It makes me damned lucky."
Though even as Sherborne shifted over her, worry nagged him. If he got Charlotte with child, that would be one more mouth to feed, one more set of expectations he could never escape, one more person who might some day, soon, be ashamed of an association with Lucas Sherborne. His immediate dependents would never be cast out into the elements, but in some ways, shabby gentility was a worse fate than outright penury. Sherborne knew from experience that disgust was easier to endure than pity. Charlotte laced her fingers with his, as if drawing him away from the gloomy precipice of his thoughts. Such was her way with a loving that Sherborne's worries fell beneath an onslaught of desire. She bit him on the shoulder at the exact right moment to drive him over the edge, though he had the satisfaction of knowing he'd taken her with him. She held back nothing, growling softly against his neck as pleasure overtook her, sinking her nails into his hip in a grip that satisfied even as it stung.
"You undo me."
Charlotte unwrapped her legs from his flanks some moments later, but kept her arms around him.
"You absolutely undo me, Lucas. One has more understanding of why newlyweds are sent away for a month, when none of their familiars will observe their adjustment to wedded bliss."
He owed her a wedding journey, another unpaid debt.
"When we've dealt with Brentford, I'll take you into Cardiff, if you like, or up to the lakes. A sea trip to the north might be pleasant."
"Winter approaches," Charlotte said,
as Sherborne slipped from her body.
"Worse yet, my mother has threatened to pay a visit. Why can't they leave us alone?"
Her lament was reassuringly grumpy. Perhaps she truly did enjoy being married to him. Sherborne rose, wrung out a flannel in the warm water by the hearth, and rinsed himself off. Charlotte propped herself on her elbows and watched from the bed.
"Keep looking at me like that, Mrs. Sherborne, and we'll be late for supper."
She flopped to her back.
"Will the world come to an end because a very tired man and his very new wife were late for supper? You'll have to do better than that, Mr. Sherborne. We can journey to the lakes in spring, assuming all goes well at the works, and it will go well."
"Radnor tells me Mr. Jones has a potential drinking problem,"
Sherborne, or some befuddled gudgeon, said.
"A man who drinks can be fatally careless. Once Brantford is gone, I'll see about replacing Jones."
Charlotte smoothed a palm over the mattress.
"Is this why you've been so preoccupied lately? Because you're worried for the works?"
"For his whole future. For their whole future."
"In part. The bank has been giving me a spot of bother as well."
"I would love to be left alone for hours at a bank,"
Charlotte said, folding her hands behind her head.
"All those lovely, lovely numbers, pages and pages of them, as far as the eye can see."
She'd not tucked the covers up high enough to hide her breasts, which was as far as Sherborne's eyes could see at the moment.
"When we're next in London, I'll turn you loose at the bank after business hours. You can prowl the ledgers like a mythical creature, spotting mistakes and inaccuracies, and breathing fire upon them."
"I'd like that."
Except, if he truly let her loose at the bank, sooner or later she'd learn that one of the investments had gone perilously sour, and Sherborne hadn't yet found a way to manage the damage. He considered explaining the canal situation to her, but she'd already closed her eyes, a goddess who'd earned her slumbers. Sherborne very nearly dressed to return to the works. Hannibal Jones was probably inebriating himself at that very moment, and the temperature was doubtless planning to plunge overnight. Charlotte sighed, a contented, sweet sound. Who knew how long she'd be content with her choice of husband? Sherborne climbed back into bed, wrapped himself around his wife, and tried to set aside thoughts of the bank, the mine, the crumbling steeple, and a nosy earl in delicate health. They all followed him into sleep anyway. Again. Chapter 17. Brantford had inherited his mines, and thus had no idea what a colliery should look like before shafts were sunk. He might have peppered Sherborne with questions, except that the Marquis of Radnor hovered at Sherborne's elbow like an underfootman new to his livery.
"You are on the board of directors for this undertaking?"
Brantford asked Radnor, as they returned to the white tent at the centre of the planned works.
"I am the assistant director of the mines board," Radnor said. "We in the peerage have an obligation to bring progress to our neighbours. Don't you agree, Brantford? What's the use of having a family seat if one doesn't take an interest in the surrounding parishes? Can't have all of our best and brightest leaving for the colonies."
"I'm told you have fine hunting on Radnor land,"
Brantford replied, though Radnor had yet to extend an invitation to either ride to hounds or try a bit of shooting. Inside the tent, Sherborne was engaged in conversation with the engineer, Hannibal Jones. Based on a few discreet inquiries, Jones had a prickly reputation, though he'd answered all of Sherborne's questions readily and with proper deference for the august guest in their midst.
"Hunting hasn't started here yet," Radnor said. "The rain has made the ground too soft, though most of the crops are off. Perhaps later in the season we'll have some sport to offer you."
"Does Sherborne ride to hounds?"
Sherborne had collected a pile of papers from the longest table in the tent, and Jones was apparently explaining something to his employer.
"Sherborne is a very competent horseman," Radnor said. "Why do you ask?"
Because making money off of Sherborne was all well and good, but too much socializing with him would not do.
"One doesn't want to create awkwardness," Brantford said. "Can't invite the man to ride in my flight, if he's likely to tumble at the first fence."
Veronica rode with the first flight, and the dash she cut in the saddle had drawn Brantford's notice even before he'd realized the ambitions her family had held for her. He'd received a letter from her that very morning, and she was having a grand time in the company of her cousins at the family seat, without her husband.
"If you're still in the area once the weather settles down,"
Radnor said,
"I'll happily take you out shooting. At least you have the famed Haverford Library to entertain you until then."
Brantford had done more reading in the past several days than in the previous 5 years. Her Grace of Haverford did not believe in allowing a guest to while away an afternoon with a plump, pretty chambermaid, when Sir Walter Scott was available instead. The Duke didn't believe in allowing anybody or anything, much less a mere titled houseguest, to upset his Duchess. Their Grace's mutual devotion was nauseatingly sincere, also slightly enviable.
"What can Sherborne be going on about?"
Brantford asked.
"Tramping around in the mud has worked up my appetite, and I'd rather not linger in this wind and caught another illness."
He'd rather not have come to Wales, and had almost put that in a letter to his wife.
"Sherborne is at these works in all kinds of weather," Radnor said. "He's here morning, noon, and night, and if you are to profit from his labours, then you can spare him a few minutes with his engineer."
So the handsome Marquis wasn't all fine manners and starched linen.
"I heartily agree," Brantford said. "Sherborne is willing to get his hands dirty, but then that's what the merchant class is for, isn't it? Getting and spending, filling the pews, minding the shops while we mind the business of the nation. He doesn't always keep to his place, but he'll make me a decent sum before too long."
The wind shifted, catching a flap of the tent and ripping it loose from its ties. Radnor captured the canvas and tied it back with a perfect bow.
"You cannot in one breath castigate Sherborne for tarrying here when there's work to be discussed, and then applaud him for having the ability to earn you substantial coin, Brantford. This mine is not a hobby for him, nor will it be for the people hoping to work here."
Though Brantford had no idea what made a mine thrive or fail, he did perceive that Sherborne had an ally in Radnor, and Radnor was a marquis who commanded the friendship of a duke.
"I mean Sherborne no insult," Brantford said. "I remark upon my own frailty. When do you expect this place will start turning a profit?"
Now Jones raised his voice, barking something about bloody damned figures. Sherborne touched Jones on the arm, and the older man grew quiet.
"Didn't you read Sherborne's financial plan?"
Radnor asked.
"Revenue should begin flowing by midsummer. The initial investments will earn out over 5 to 10 years, depending on how quickly the mine repays the initial principal and at what percentage interest."
Sherborne tucked some papers into a satchel and left Jones to fuss with the parlour stove.
"My apologies for detaining you both," Sherborne said. "Brantford, any other questions?"
By rights, no commoner ought to have used such familiar address. "My lord, your lordship, Lord Brantford" were acceptable, but Radnor was 2 yards away, tying the tent flap closed, so Brantford kept his scold behind his teeth.
"I believe I've seen all there is to see at this point," Brantford said.
I hope you intend to set a fine table this evening, Sherborne, for hiking about has left me famished. In fact, the relentless smell of